welcome to this week's Yes to Life show. I'm Robin Daly, and I'm the founder and chairman of the UK charity Yes to Life. This year, as part of our 10-year celebrations, CAM Expo, the UK's leading professional complementary, natural and integrative health show, invited us to host a panel event entitled The C Word, 1 hour of question and answer to our 6-strong panel of experts. Our programme this week is a little unusual and consists of recorded material from this panel event. To make sure you know who's speaking, I've dubbed in speaker names throughout the recording.
My name's Robin Daly. I'm the chairman of Yes to Life, which is a UK registered charity which is helping people to access integrative medicine when they've got cancer. Before I start, I'd like to do a little sales pitch for the charity, just a tiny one. Okay, so we've been going 10 years, and today is kind of the heart of our 10-year celebration. We've been supported fantastically by CAM Expo for years now, and they've pushed the boat out for us this year, given us this fantastic Q&A. And for that, I built up this stellar cast on my left here to answer every question you've got, as long as it's on the subject of integrative medicine, of course. So the charity directly supports people with cancer. We support them by running a helpline, which is there to give them support. It's there to be a signposter to give them some decent information quickly about what might help them in their given situation. We give them direct support through funding as well, because it's all very well knowing what you should be doing, but if you haven't got any money, you're stumped. So we support them as best we can financially. And we also have a lot of information on our website. We have a unique directory on our website of practitioners and therapies all linked together, who's doing what, where they're doing it, and what it might be useful for. So that's in a nutshell the kind of thing we do. So with no more ado, let's just introduce our stellar panel over here. So right down the end there, Jennifer Young. Jennifer Young is a microbiologist, all sorts of complicated things. She's here particularly because she set up her own range, her own company, supplying a range of cosmetics and general personal care products, which are specifically aimed at people with cancer, which means that they're nice. Next is Jane Doyle. Jane, in her long career, the last role she had was heading up UCH's complementary therapy team, supporting people with cancer at the Newman Burn Centre. And she's now set up on her own, but she's obviously got enormous experience of directly dealing with people with cancer and what their needs are and what the precautions around working with people with cancer would be. Next, we've got Barbara. Barbara Galani is a scientist, but she's also a yoga expert, and she's particularly trained to work with people with cancer, so she has a lot to say about the role of exercise and recovery from cancer. Next is Zandria Williams. Zandria's got a lengthy career. She's also a microbiologist. She's a naturopath, and the last 10 years or more, she's been specifically working with people with cancer. She's written copious books, very extensive, very detailed books on the whole process of cancer at every stage. And she's now running courses for people to actually learn how to use nutrition effectively for cancer. So she's a great asset here. So any questions on nutrition and cancer, naturopathy, she's here for. I'll sell that to this end. Rob Booker will be known to many of you, the man who set up the Alliance for Natural Health. He is a scientist, and he's been working tirelessly on behalf of natural medicines, natural approaches, both here and in America and in Europe. And he knows his way around the legalities to do with cancer, all the precautions we need to be taking in order to keep on the right side of the law, as well as many other things. So he's a real expert in this territory. Next to him is not Dr. Andre Young Snell, as it says on the bill, but as it now says on the slide correctly, it's Dr. Damien Danny. Unfortunately, Andre wasn't able to come at the last minute, and our hero and chief medical advisor to the charity, Dr. Damien Danny, has stepped in at the 11th hour. So a round of applause for our panel. So today is all about questions, all right? This panel was built with a view to be somebody there and give you a decent answer to any question you're likely to come up with on this subject. So take full advantage of this opportunity to find out what you want to find out. I'd even like the panel to be questioning each other if they feel so inclined. Let's get as much debate going here as possible. Actually, I'm going to weigh in with the first question just to actually set the ball rolling here. Right? So, I'm assuming that all our panellists and all of you here, our audience, would like to see a broad range of complementary medicine fully integrated into cancer care in Britain as soon as possible. So what do you think are the actions that we can take that will have the most effect in moving things in that direction? Take it away, any of our panellists, all of our panellists, please.
It's Andrea Williams. Yes.
I've been in Australia 20 years, head of a naturopathic association, and I've been here nearly 20 years. Spent a lot of time in politicking and trying to get regulations in so we can do all the things we think are so important. I'm not absolutely convinced that our best way forward is to get the biggest possible groundswell of people who want to go on having and have even more of what we are offering and doing. We're not going to do it from the top, in my experience. In Australia, we had, in about 1980, a move to make all supplements down to the RDA level, 2 milligrams of this, 45 milligrams of vitamin C, no more. And it would have killed this whole industry 40 years ago, or whatever it is, 35. With an association of several of the health food product companies, plus the Naturopathic Association, we got 150,000 letters to Canberra. An MP protesting and saying, we want vitamins, we do not want this legislation stopping us. An MP there, and presumably here, considers that one letter to Parliament is equivalent to 500 votes. 499 people who think the same or vote the same way as if it goes ahead. If you multiply 500 by about 17 million, the population of Australia, you've got more than the total population of Australia being against the restriction on the natural therapies in general. That stopped the legislation stone dead. Don't think it's writing to practitioners and to the MPs as effective it is. My interest, and in particularly running these 6 progressive seminars, one-day seminars on cancer, and at the CNM College, I want to train as many students, practitioners, as much as quickly as I can, so that they can be more and more effective against cancer naturopathically, so that it gets harder and harder, like opening Pandora's box, to keep the lid on it. And I think the grassroots way is a really important way to do it, as well as whatever lobby or individual legislative and other things.
Thank you, Zen. Anybody else?
Rob Verkirk.
Raise the issue of research. Science does the talking politically in terms of being a key driver for any kind of top-down shift by the medical establishment. One of the difficulties we have with any complex disease, and cancer doesn't get much more complex when you look at the epigenetic background, is that we don't now have a system that allows us to look at any multi-modality approach. You look at any practitioner that's actually gaining good success rates in the field of oncology, they're using multiple systems applied together. And of course, if you look at certain branches of research like comparative effectiveness research, the work that Dr. Biss and others are doing, you look at outcome-based research, even simple things like the development of MIMOC2 and other systems like that, we have the beginnings of a system that can start to enter in, if you like, more of a black box system that's less focused on mechanisms, that is really looking at people with condition X becoming healthy or healthier based on a number of markers. Now, one of the things we're talking about with people around the world on this issue, and there's, I'll mention one of the big insurance companies for the CAM field, David Valens, is something that he's very keen to support now, is development in the UK with the view to it moving global, a research hub in which standardized systems of data collection at the clinical level can be used so that we can actually start to get, if you like, big data on the sheer positivity of results that are happening. And I think until we start focusing on that, we're going to be in more and more difficulty, particularly with some of the legislation like the Nutritional Health Claims Regulation that is basically saying we will not consider any data unless it's on healthy populations. And immediately you can see you discount the vast last 30, 40, 50 years of research simply because it's being carried out on diseased populations. So we need multifactorial, multimodality research methods based on outcomes in order to be able to shift essentially the way in which most people in decision-making positions are thinking about cancer.
It's Andrea Williams.
On that basis, too, we need to get away from thinking of the double-blind placebo-controlled clinical trials that test one thing against an outcome, when we are dealing with the total body with multiple components, a bit like checking your car, so we'll just check one wheel. If that wheel doesn't work, even when it's puffed up, we'll blame the puffed up wheel and forget that the other three wheels weren't attended. So I mean, we've got to have a different, like you're saying, a different approach to testing. The testing is all designed to test a one-off drug with no other factor taken into account. So we're a multifactorial approach.
Okay. Barbara Galani.
I'm staying in this topic around the science and the scientific evidence because I come from a very, very strict scientific training and background. And teaching yoga, you realise that the double-blind tests are not possible. And the first thing I did when I started working with cancer patients was the literature review. And there are promising factors, but lots of limitations in the research that's always conducted. So I think as a first step to start and introduce yoga as a very valuable complementary therapy, what I'd really like to see more of is in order to raise awareness of it amongst the medical profession is to have more case studies, more personal stories, detailed descriptions of how individuals find it beneficial. So from a scientific perspective, as it's considered now, it might not be that valuable, but in terms of raising awareness and making people willing to try the practice is probably a good thing.
Dr. Downing.
I think that the example of homeopathy shows us that probably a waste of time and effort trying to go down the mainstream scientific route here, do the research. You do the double-blind controlled trials, and they say, well, that's no good, you need systematic reviews. And then you do the systematic reviews, and they say, oh, well, we don't agree with that. We did think this one, which shows what we want to show, is the best systematic review. And, I mean, the impact on homeopathy is huge, really. Very bad. So it's a complete waste of time going down that route. I agree with you. We need to have a multimodal approach, which is absolutely true. But we need to find new ways of addressing it. And the other thing, of course, is that we all know that it's not really going to be the change here. It's not going to be driven by doctors or indeed by the authorities. It's going to be driven by the patients. That's precisely what's been obvious for the past, I don't know, 20 years, 30 years. And the other thing that's changed now, of course, is the activism and self-education are so much more possible because of the internet. You can be an expert patient, you can, and you can make your voice heard.
Hey, find the table, Jennifer. What do you think we can do to move things along?
Jennifer Young.
Well, I agree with everything that's been said. I have a scientific background, and I think the science and the research and creating credibility is incredibly important. But I think if we bring it back to what we can do as individuals, we look to the NHS, we use their language, and we look at the voice of the patient. And it will, I think change is being driven by quiet expectation that complementary therapies will be included as part of an integrated care package when people ask for it. Health authorities, the NHS, within the private health sector, they're all very focused on what is it that we're expected to deliver? And I think if you expect them to deliver integrated care, then they will rise to that.
Jane, you've worked with in the NHS quite a lot, so what do you think is going to bring about change?
I'm not sure, is the short answer, but I agree with everything that's been said so far. And just from a patient perspective, and patients driving change, practitioners, complementary therapy practitioners driving change, and as well as looking at evidence-based or practice, looking at practice-based evidence to say, this is what I have found in my clinic when I'm seeing people, and to be well-educated yourself, to search out the highest training you can find, the best training you can find in this country. So you do know the contraindications to practice or the cautions of practicing, and then you'll be ready when we have got everyone else on board. There is a lot of talk at the moment with commissioning and commissioning health services. So to find your local cancer-specific network and to see what they're doing with the money that is coming in, because I think there's quite a lot of money around at the moment, and speaking to the people, speaking to GP, what are you offering, speak to your hospitals, and make a nuisance of yourself, possibly, which is what I did, and that's how I got to where I was, and probably why I'm sat here now. So to keep pushing things forward, and I think, as Jennifer said, to make it an expectation, because it's there, and people are using complementary therapies.
Brilliant. Okay, so that's got our panel warmed up. I'm going to throw it out to the floor now, and here's our first questioner.
There's a fundamental logjam, though, like a sword of Damocles over all cancer patients, and that is that the Cancer Act, 1939 Cancer Act, which actually makes it illegal to treat a cancer patient other than by surgery, chemotherapy, or radiotherapy. And this is preventing treatment by many physicians, other than in a euphemistic way that they're supporting their immune system and their nutrition being helping them. And what that is doing is that there's no evidence being collected from people that are going through integrated programs that go onto the official cancer databases. And therefore, oncologists, it's like the three monkeys, you know, see no evil, speak no evil, hear no evil. They don't know anything about alternative treatment, and people routinely contact me and say, oh, well, I've been diagnosed and I'm off, you know, I've been booked in for chemotherapy. And they're not even being given the information that enables them to have informed consent for the treatment. And I'm afraid that I have come to the conclusion after over 20 years of research, really, very lamentably, that the side effects of chemotherapy and sometimes radiotherapy can be really life-threatening. And it's and if you can't legally treat somebody, I know there are some clinics that are treating cancer patients, but they're not overtly treating it. And of course, the Saatchi Innovation Bill last year, which wouldn't have really been a huge innovation anyway, but that didn't work, and there was a huge outcry from the medical profession. So I'm afraid this is something that, you know, has been going on for decades, really, maybe a century. And I'd like to hear the panel's view on that.
Okay, so much spoken about, lots of hands going up in the panel. That's good. The Cancer Act, obviously, it has had and continues to have a large effect. Just how big is that effect, really? And do we need to do something about that? And if so, what? Let's start at this end. Rob, you had your hand up.
Rob,
I think the first thing is to remove the sword of Damocles, because it's a major psychological obstacle. We have to understand exactly what the Cancer Act does. What it really does is prevent the promotion and advertising of anything that is not mainstream oncology. That is the very reason that this kind of oncology is driven underground, I'll agree. But while it sits there and we see it as a barrier, we don't progress. Second aspect comes back to what I mentioned before, that and it's been mentioned a number of times, that by communicating stories of positive responses, people who have very difficult to treat
cancers, for example, pancreatic cancer would be a good example. Roughly 2 to 5%, depending where you are or whose statistics you look at, of people recover from pancreatic cancer. We have a research program running at Imperial College now that I'm co-supervising that is bringing together the data of those success rates so we can look epigenetically at what is it about those individuals. The reality is that many of the ones that we have been in contact with are actually using complementary therapies. And so we have to change, if you like, our mindset in terms of what is going on. The biggest problem that we have, yes, is lack of acceptance by conventional medicine. There is literally a brick wall that divides the kind of information that we're talking about with what is understood, if you like, on both sides of this wall. I believe that the linking point will become epigenetics. There is so much new data now where it's becoming well understood that diet and lifestyle are probably the two single most important components that affect our risk to cancer. The reality is that this is still pushed into some sort of childlike compartment for which there is no real science. But actually, when you break down in a much more scientific manner what we mean by diet and lifestyle, exactly what kind of programs are utilized to make a difference, it can become, the language can become more scientific again. And then once we see that you don't need to just study SNPs or single nucleotide polymorphisms based on drug susceptibility, most of the most positive responses actually link to modifications to a diet and lifestyle, I believe the medical establishment will become more receptive. But above all, yes, it is this bottom-up push, this patient-driven push, in which people are able to locate the right kind of practitioner with the right kind of experience that can actually help assist this individual to find homeostasis or allostasis. And that paradigm is a paradigm that we need to fundamentally shift. We still have the majority of people involved in professional healthcare believing that there is a need to treat the symptoms of a disease rather than deal with the entire terrain of that individual to create a circumstance that allows the body to actually naturally heal itself. And once we have a clearer understanding of that process, the process that allows homeostasis to be re-achieved, we can actually forget about having to criminalize the activity. If you look at medical doctors at the moment working in this field, they have the toughest job of anyone, simply because they have the General Medical Council breathing down at them saying that you are applying a treatment that doesn't comply with NICE guidelines. So we need to change that terrain. It's not something that's going to happen overnight, but there are many indications to suggest that the language of the Cancer Act, the language of conventional oncology will become less and less relevant for these complex diseases.
Thank you.
Dr. Downing.
Can I just say, first off, that I don't treat cancer. I do treat patients, and some of them have cancer, but I don't treat cancer, and actually, I wouldn't want it any other way. The doctors who have the ability to remove lumps and to slash and burn, they're treating cancer, but they're not treating the patients. If you had the ability to do that, would you want to do it? As a camp practitioner or whatever, that's the weakness of the mainstream oncological approach, and it's the strength of ups. And it does mean that in order to get change, in order to help patients, there has to be that paradigm shift, that reframing, to think about treating the patients. So, I mean, that's all good really, isn't it?
Andrea Williams.
Carry on that vein, particularly. As I understand it, Robert might change it. I think the Act says you can't treat cancer, not that you can't treat people with cancer. And I don't, as a naturopath, in Australia, a naturopath has a 4-year degree course, and the whole focus is on restoring homeostasis. It's not semantics to say I don't treat people or I don't treat a disease. I'm interested in what is wrong in somebody at the cellular level and putting it right. And if their tumour disappears, well, whoopee, isn't that great? I'm not put off by the Cancer Act. I just have to watch my words extremely carefully. Somebody comes in and says, oh, do you treat cancer? And I say, yes. And they've recorded it and probably in trouble. But if they say that, and I say, well, look, I can look at you and aim at restoring your health. One of my card here, I have been treating people, not cancer. And even treating people is, I rather like the wording of it. In the books that I write and the six sequential seminars on cancer I run, it's all about restoring normal health, rebuilding health. Cancer is a long process. The tumor might come 10 years after you start along that process. We have tests that will detect cancer process start off 5, maybe 10 years before anybody has a tumor, and we have research to show that. So I'm looking at this process. We have a lot of tests that say, oh, you're building too many new blood vessels. You better stop because you're probably building them for a tumor. We don't call it a tumor. We don't say that's cancer, but you're going down this process. We have blood extracts that will stop that and so forth. I agree that the legislation does frighten a lot of, or worry a lot of practitioners, but if you take it seriously and then watch your words and understand that what we're doing in somebody is rebuilding their health from the ground up, not attacking the tumor, as Robert said, we don't need to be deterred by that, and it helps us to focus, in fact, on the fundamental operation of this of restoring health from a cellular level up. I'm a biochemist, and I teach biochemistry for 8 hours tomorrow, a lot. And it's getting that restoration of homeostasis. It's a slightly clumsy word, Robert used it, but it's returning to natural, normal health. And don't let's be frightened by the... I was at the seminar yesterday, as was Dr. Downing here, and it was largely by somewhat retired in the sense of being old. I mean, surgeons saying, well, we think now we actually cause more cancer than we cured. Somebody saying the NHS is just not fulfilling its grief. Very interesting talk I brought at the end of it. So many people, even within the... We know that in one study, 72% of oncologists couldn't take their own medicine. There is a much bigger, or give it to their family, there is a much bigger groundswell here if we can just not be afraid to speak out, but speak out very carefully and constructively.
Okay, thanks, Andrew. Right, so can we have a question now which is more on the practical side? We've had the scientific and legal end here. Have we got somebody who wants to ask something which is a bit more on the practical side of giving complementary therapies? Okay, so we have a lady down here.
I'm not sure if this meets your immediate brief, but it would seem to me with the current situation of the NHS and the funding of the NHS.
And when I was particularly on ward, many people didn't know we were there, and the service has been established for 10, 15 years, if not more. So that was a surprise to me. I can't really see, sorry. The light's in the way. And so I asked that question, why don't people know? And they were telling me that leaflets should be included when you are admitted to hospital. You often have an information pack, and that there's often information in there about complementary therapies on offer. Lovely, but I know when you're admitted to hospital, it's a very traumatic time. It's a very fearful time. You've got a lot going on. And so you don't always take in that information. So when I was working within those services, one of the things I was trying to do was train the nurses to remind them that we were there and that the service is offered to patients. And actually, it's not routinely offered in all NHS trusts. It is in London, in many of them. You've got the Christie in Manchester and one or two dotted around, but it's not everywhere. So even if you do ask, if you know about it, you might not have access to it. So that would be my mission, because at the moment we are working. This is as far as I can see at the moment, we are working in an integrated way. The system may have its fault, the approach may have its fault, but thank goodness for consultants. Thank goodness for surgery. And to be frank, thank goodness for chemotherapy and radiotherapy at times, it saves lives. So the context, I think, at the moment of where I work with hands-on therapies, I think it's quite different if you're working at a biochemical level. Fabulous that I'm there. I'm really pleased with that. And I can educate consultants and nurses whilst I'm there. I'm losing my train of thought. So my goal would be, if you all go out, if you tell everybody, if you champion your GP practice, your NHS hospital, where are the complementary therapies? And so I think, as people are saying, it's the groundswell. And people like me being very stubborn and trying to pursue a career in the NHS as it stands at the moment, because I think we can offer something very soft and soothing and certainly help to address fear and anxiety and lots of other things which I hopefully will talk about at some point, but actually what we can do to help. So thank I think you. You're not alone in having that experience of not being aware, but I'm glad you found out.
Barbara's keen to say something.
Yeah, my experience of education on a personal level around the yoga for cancer patients is around the fact that you can only inform and educate people who are already quite open. And the way it worked for me, after setting up the class and working with the students, there was one particular student with a very advanced case of liver cancer who spoke very, very highly about the benefits that she was receiving during the classes. And that opened up an opportunity for me to speak with the breast cancer nurse and to have her at class, to try the classes, to speak with more patients. She gave me the highest ever number of referrals, so that are still continuing. But I've not found it particularly easy to speak directly with nurses and doctors without that very personal introduction. So again, it starts from the bottom, and then we can only go so far to really pass the message as well.
This gentleman has been holding his arm up very extensively, and I'm going to give him the floor.
I've got a question with regards to another C word that I've never really seen spoken about much in the care sector. I've really got much experience in this sector, but I've done a lot of research in this area, and that's with regards to medicinal cannabis. And, you know, everyone talks about the regulations for the last 12 years, but the turmeric and natural gum is not the first herbs to get made illegal. You just have to look all the way back to after the First World War, 1930s, to actually see, just before the British left India, that they knew the benefits of these herbs industrially and medicinally, and that's why they made it illegal, and a whole lot of other issues. It was the same time as the Cancer Act, and all the way from the girls in Mexico who's managed to get a dose of medicinal cannabis to the fearless father in Australia for his little daughter. How comes we don't entertain even a conversation on medicinal cannabis while most of the research is from oncologists and medicine doctors? That's what I find a bit strange. It's not just the medicinal benefits, it's also the industrial benefits for the soil as well. So I'd like to see, even if the question doesn't get answered today, I'd just like to see on the page and actually show the people who are making all these other herbs illegal that until we, well, if everyone looks at my t-shirt, this is a picture of George Washington in jail. The reason why he's in jail is because of cannabis being made illegal. Until we recognize cannabis and recognize it as the first herb that was made illegal before these other Indian ones, we're never really going to get a reprisal for all these other herbs in the last 12 years. So if there's anyone that can answer these very contentious questions, I'd be very happy to, because there's a lot of research all the way from very first research in Tel Aviv University in Israel, an Israeli medical doctor, he started it off, and all the way back to people in California.
Okay,
well, one of them from non-CAN people.
I'll stop you there. Let's get some answers, okay? Thank you very much. First of all, anybody like to speak about the evidence of whatever level it is behind the use of cannabis as something to approach cancer?
Rob Vicker.
There is a lot of research in palliative care, and the difficulty, the particular difficulty is obviously you are dealing with an illicit drug that has its own separate piece of legislation, but it is being considered. The difficulty, I mean, it's like it's got twice as many problems in terms of being entertained by people who are on a self-care drive. So it would always be something that would have to be prescribed. One of the difficulties, if you look at the paradigm shift that we were talking about earlier, is where you actually put a patient in the driving seat and you allow that individual. At very high levels in the NHS, in the long-term diseases section, they are really fundamentally trying to move towards a paradigm shift in which you change the position of a doctor in the field of any of these serious long-term diseases from being a god to being a guide. So as Robin said earlier, we've had to entertain since 1946 in the NHS constitution this notion of patient-centered care. We've been a million miles away from it for more than half a century, and there is now sufficient education and knowledge out there, partially because of the internet. That means that there are people turning up in their doctor's surgeries who know more about how to self-care than the doctor does. And that is how revolutions begin. If they then say, look, doc, I want to light up a spliff because it's going to cure my cancer, I think we're a little way off from that.
Right, that's great. I think that was a good answer for that. Now, we have not so much more time, so does anybody feel they've got a question on a subject we haven't been anywhere near yet, or not that near to? Sure, yes?
I think it's kind of a simple question. Once you get diagnosed with cancer, you have two choices, or go to chemotherapy, or refuse to have chemotherapy. Now, the question is, when you get this sentence, and you don't know what to do, what would you recommend first? In a sense, of course, you cannot overwrite what the doctor says in some ways, but it's a big responsibility and it's up to the patient to decide what to do. But as a practitioner, as an alternative practitioner, would you recommend to try an alternative method first or to go through chemotherapy and then support holistically what is the outcome of the chemo?
Dr. Downing.
Can I give you a very short answer to that? Ketogenic diet.
It's
up to you, I was going to say that.
So would you go directly with a ketogenic diet as a first step, see what the results would be?
Because it's important in so many different ways, including that there's emerging evidence that it's got a synergistic effect with the conventional therapies if you do choose to take them.
It's Andrea Williams.
I think it's going to very much depend on an individual who's automatic responses to be pumped into drugs or into something. And we need to use, if you said the words rightly, there is complementary therapy, which technically is where nutritionists and other people generally work, complementing whatever else they're doing. It may be chemotherapy, it may be some completely different therapy. I don't see that you can do any harm by putting the diet right and a low carbohydrate diet, certainly part of it. The evidence also is really interesting. I was at a conference where radiation was getting an increase in life expectancy of the treatment. When you added curcumin to it, they were getting a 40% improvement. So why not do both, except your oncologist was, oh, you mustn't do that. But there's no actual proof. I say patients, when they come and see me, if they say that you mustn't do so-and-so, ask them for the research paper and the proof, and then bring it to your practitioner if you can't sort it out. We know that if you put the broccoli component, I3C, tamoxifen, which has all its side effects, gets a 40% improvement in outcome. If you use I3C injected into the tumor site, you get a 95% improvement. If you add tamoxifen as well, you get a 98% improvement. Is it worth it for the adults? There are many examples where using both complementarily can work. Sometimes the chemotherapy, by really harming the immune system, can hold back the alternative options. For the people who say, well, actually, I don't want any of the medical, I want the alternatives, then that's when you use the word alternative. There are many. There's Professor Abo in Japan, who's very keen on alternative options. And he'll say, as in many other people, that really the only time they would use the medical options is surgery when it's space occupying or causing some other problem, and that it can pull down the immune system. But if you work, it's up to the patient. You know, you want to decide at the end of the day which outcome you can live with. You tried this and it didn't work. Well, you think, oh, I'm silly to do that. Or are you really keen to do something else? And many people will start and they'll make tentative steps. Many of my patients say, well, I'll do this, but no more. I'm doing all the other things. And then gradually they think, well, I'll do a bit more. There's no getting into the alternative, naturopathic, better diet and lifestyle. I mean, Professor Biavi in Milan University thinks that cancer, as Robert was saying, is as much as 93% caused by lifestyle, within which you include diet, of course. Do them both. Do as much as you can in all ways.
Barbara, you want to say something?
Barbara Galani.
My view, the way I use yoga with cancer patients is very much to support the conventional therapies. There are a lot of side effects, there are a lot of changes in the body, whether they're drastic through surgery or gradual through chemotherapy or radiotherapy. And the way I use yoga, and I'm very upfront about it, is really to help people get to the end of the course of the radiotherapy, chemotherapy treatment, by helping reconnect with the body and strengthen the body, and using the breath in certain circumstances to control the pain. So for me, it's very much a support tool rather than an alternative way of addressing the illness.
Okay, thank you. Just to add into that,
on your question, just to make sure that obviously critical is to ensure that that you make very clear to the patient or the client that they should be managing or have their condition seen to by conventional medicine, and just understand in terms of even something like the ketogenic diet, there are specific practitioners who specialize in ketogenic diets for cancer. They may struggle with some of that simply because nutrition is actually not viewed by mainstream medicine as a complementary therapy or an alternative medicine. It is fully a component of dietetics, and dietetics is the type of nutrition that gives ice cream and Mars bars for people with cancer and well master. So there is a big re-education there, and there are some fantastic websites where with the right handling you can actually educate the GP and the oncologist to understanding this is a big growth area, particularly for brain tumors. But yes, you have to do it that way around. And the final thing I'd say is just the very fact that we're talking about things like ketogenic diets and yoga as being things that can support people with cancer is because actually those are things that we need to be doing lifelong. They are part of our evolutionary background, and that's the reason they allow homeostatic processes to start working again.
It's Andrea Williams.
But we do need to keep, if I can just add this, that we are not treating cancer, we're treating people. One diet doesn't fit all. One treatment doesn't fit all. I've had people with various diseases, which will be nameless, on completely different first diets, because it's the one that's right for correcting their metabolism. And not necessarily, some people will do well on ketogenic, some will do completely well on something else. It's really important to find out how that person's metabolism functions. Some people need calcium. For some people with their osteoporosis, you give them calcium, you'll simply dump it in their soft tissue and the artery walls. They're better off with magnesium. And you need to find out what's right for the individual. And keep in mind that we're not treating a disease, we're treating or helping people put their own bodies right.
Thank you. Okay, we had an online questionnaire leading up to this. It was quite interesting to see what people did. How many people here are actual practitioners? What have we got there? It's about half, I would say. The online answer to the question of how confident the practitioners felt about treating their patients got an extraordinarily high 92%. Is that a similar feeling in here? And people who are practitioners, how do you feel about working with people with cancer? Do you feel confident about it? Give us a hands up if it's a yes. A lot less. Right, okay, that's interesting. And but you know, this is something that this Q&A is designed to do something about, to find out, rather than this rather vague, oh, it's all a bit scary, isn't it? If people are interested, and I assume that you're here because you are interested to help people with cancer, we need to know, well, where are the lines really? The hard lines are things you, the places you don't go, the things you don't say, the things you don't do, but actually, what are the things you can do? And there is clearly an awful lot that you can do. I hope that's the message that's coming off the platform today. Okay, so we've got a little bit more time here. This lady with the headscarf first.
People with cancer who wish to access integrative treatment can only do that really by being the drivers of their own care, and are advised to, you know, build a team that includes their oncologist as a member of the team, rather than having the oncologist sort of being the boss and being in charge. But I wondered if the panel have advice on how patients can navigate the NHS if you're, you know, if patients have, as many do, consultants who are not supportive. And as an example of that, you know, I mean, consultants who are not supportive of their plans to try and, you know, have an integrated treatment plan. As an example of that, Dr. Pfeiffer was recommending, you know, a particular protocol and saying that it's only worth following that protocol if that's being monitored on a regular basis through, for example, blood marker tests to see if it's working for that individual. As Zandria said, not, it wouldn't necessarily suit every individual. But if you're, if that patient's consultant refuses to do those blood marker tests or is unsupportive in any, you know, of what the patient's trying to do more generally, how does what advice is there for patients to help them navigate that?
Yes, Rob.
Rob Vicker.
I just want to give a plug for what Robin and Yes to Life are doing, because essentially what patients who know that there is something out there that might involve things that are not currently viewed as valid therapies, because I have a bit of a problem with language sometimes. Complementary and alternative therapies are still to some extent defined and considered by those in mainstream medicine as therapies that have been proven not yet proven to work. But what happens when a particular patient who believes they have cancer or has had cancer diagnosed finds Yes to Life, they're effectively held and they're steered and they're directed to people who can provide that support. And that is a key function. And to some extent, to get the word out, and I know the Daily Mail hasn't necessarily helped with the Google rankings here and there, and you'll understand that there are people who work tirelessly to make that happen and damage the reputation of some very, very good causes. But to get the word out that people need contact an organisation like Yes to Life, and to look also at the BSIO, the British Society of Integrated Oncology, is a place in which practitioners can come together to share information. That is actually, these are two important repositories of information for which people can come together, get educated, share experiences, and get the word out. We live in a world in which social media is now absolutely key. Getting amazing stories out there into the system. You won't necessarily read about them in the Guardian, I should say. But you may read one day on a particular schizophrenic day or the Daily Mail, you may read about them there. But getting stories out of social media is really key. And things are changing, and they are, despite some of the negative things that are happening, overwhelmingly, things are moving in the right direction.
Thank you. So, just a little plug there for the British Society for Integrative Oncology. If you're a practitioner and you've got any interest in helping people with cancer, you should go and look at the website and find out about it and consider joining up. There are a few leaflets on the end of the stage there, which is the first come, first served.
Yeah, and
Jane Doyle.
Just to sort of champion more massage therapies, hands-on therapies, aromatherapy, reflexology, which is what I do, is be persistent, keep asking, keep doing it anyway. If you go to something like Yes to Life, Penny Boy in Bristol, look at CNHC, FHT, some of the leading professional bodies, and find a registered practitioner. Find some and speak to them. Speak to them, ask them what additional training they've had with supporting people in a supportive, complementary way, and do it.
I
can I say, I'm very keen, and I've worked a lot with children and teenagers, very passionate, and I've worked with adults, I've worked with all age groups. So can we not forget children in all of this? And can we not forget with children that have a cancer diagnosis, there's a whole family around them. So I think that's interesting to look at as well, as it is with other long-term conditions.
Thank you.
I will stop myself as I'll go on.
Ross, yes. I think the key point there is that
Rob Vicker.
You asked, your question was about how do you navigate within the NHS? The reality is if you're faced with an oncologist that is not supportive, you navigate, but you will need to navigate in the private system outside the NHS. And many people find that some of the best results, and you can go into the Yes to Life portal and be steered in particular directions to the right kind of practitioners. Many people find that some of the best balance in the end, the oncologist is going to be monitoring the state of the tumour, the development of the cancer, metastases. They provide a very, very useful function. They may, in the end, think it is their targeted chemotherapy or radiotherapy that's working. It doesn't really matter. The fact is that you may have gone outside that scope to do a number of other things. They tend not to be that interested, but in the end, what you're looking at is combining the best mix of different protocols that deliver the best possible results. And that's something the oncologist will be pleased to see, and they're providing the data on the back of the NHS on how you're progressing. So very often what you'll find, even if they're not interested, they'll say, keep doing what you're doing, in the knowledge that things are happening that they don't understand, they cannot be seen to support, but you carry on doing that. And that's why it's so important that you have a system outside of the NHS that can actually steer you in the right direction. Yes to Life is one of the key systems in this country.
Okay, thanks for the plug. That's certainly the case. Yes, you can approach the charity for help with that. Okay.
I'd just like to know their websites for all these virtual people using.
Okay, I'm going to give you our website address, and then we will make sure that all the other website addresses are available there. Okay, so our website address is yes to life, yestolife.org.uk. Let's keep it simple, okay?
It's Andrea Williams.
If you just put BSIO into an internet search engine, you'll come up with our
BSIO? Yes, exactly. Right. I want to finish with what I meant to start with, which was to ask our panellists just to tell us what they're most excited about what's happening in integrative medicine at the moment. In the UK particularly would be nice, but it's all very well hearing about great things happening elsewhere, but it's actually here that we're interested in, of course. So let's just run down the table, starting with you, Rob.
Rob Vicker.
I think on one hand there is change, and the change within the mainstream sector is actually coming from the people who are worried about the economics. The King's Fund reports that are saying the NHS will break under the strain of chronic diseases. So there is the beginnings of change at that level. Even more exciting than that is the fact that we're seeing more people than ever who are voting with their feet and are voting for natural medicine as an option and integration of medicine. And that steamroller will change the face of healthcare. It's happened before, it's going to happen again, and that's why please do not ever give up.
Thank you. Damien.
Dr. Downing.
I have to be quite brief about this, otherwise it would be a very long story. But really, I think the exciting thing that's happened now is that we're realising that with an integrative approach, use all the different, come at it from several different directions at once, you really do get positive results, you get cumulative effects, you get synergy. And we can achieve, practitioners, as patients, can achieve much more now than was possible 10 years ago.
Thank you, Andy. Zandria
Williams.
I'm particularly excited, so I'm going to answer this personally. The first cancer seminar I started earlier this year thinking we'd be a handful of people, and within 2 weeks it was 50 people full with a waiting list, mainly practitioners. What I'm really excited about is a huge number of practitioners who are really keen to get a really structured approach and move this whole thing forward. And personally, I'm just really excited about running this whole seminar series. It's a personal answer, but...
That's great. Thank you. Thanks, Andrew.
Barbara Galani.
yoga is becoming more and more popular, and a lot of yoga teachers are becoming interested, and I'm getting more and more requests for little chats about how to use yoga with the cancer patients. And Iyengar School published a book on yoga for cancer, because it's one of the most known schools within the yoga family. I think it's going to make a difference.
Great, great, thank you.
Jane Doyle.
I was really, really excited to be working on the wards with people, children and adults, and their families, offering something that soothes the fear and pain. And I look forward to doing that again.
And Jennifer.
Jennifer, yeah.
The change. I'm really excited about the change in expectations, the changes in behaviour, the changes in questions that are being asked, just the general shift into integration.
Thank you. So, I'd just like you to put your hands together for our panel. I'd also like you to seriously consider supporting Yes for Life. Demand for our services is rocketing at the moment as we begin to get better known. You can imagine how many people there are who would like to take an integrative approach, but they're ill, they've got cancer, and they maybe haven't got any money. We actually are going to need much greater resources in the near future. So if you consider becoming a friend of Yes to Life and actually supporting us ongoingly, that would be a fantastic contribution. Okay, I think that's all for now. Thank you very much indeed for coming.
I thoroughly enjoyed the event, and it was clear that we could have easily gone on a lot longer. It was a real pleasure and an honour to have such a panel of experts to share their depth of experience and their crude wisdom. As usual, links to sites and resources mentioned in the show are on the Yes to Life website. Just go to yestolife.org.uk, yestolife, yestolife.org.uk, and click the link to radio in the left-hand sidebar. Next week, I should be speaking to a mycologist, or to put that in plain English, mushroom expert. His name's Martin Powell, and I'm going to be investigating with him one of our most important natural resources for defence against cancer, mushrooms. So do be sure not to miss what's certain to be a fascinating show. Goodbye.